This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehiz Wahib in Washington, and here is what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
As you are seeing, we've won the election. I'm an MPP man, and we are happy. We're all Ghanaians, though, but we are happy that the MPP has won the election. And we are happy that everything is going on peacefully, and we are all enjoying.
That's the sound of Ghanaians celebrating presidential election results as they were being announced. Details coming up. Also, refugees fleeing the fighting in Ethiopia say they do not know the fate of their families left behind. And today is International Human Rights Day, and hundreds in Cameroon are calling for an end to separatist violence and Boko Haram terrorism. All these and more ahead on Africa News Tonight. But first, our top story. Official results from Ghana's election Monday show incumbent President Nana Akufo-Addo has won a second term. Stacey Knott reports from Accra.
Supporters celebrated on the streets of Accra after poll authorities declared President Nana Akufo-Addo the winner of Monday's election. He beat his opponent, former President John Mahama, by a margin of 51 to 47%. In a post on his Facebook page, the president spoke Wednesday night after the Electoral Commission announced the results.
The Ghanaian people, through the results, have made it loud and clear that the two parties, the MPP and NDC, must work together, especially in Parliament, for the good of the country.
Final results in the parliamentary vote are yet to be announced, but it's possible that Akufo-Addo's New Patriotic Party may lose its majority. Some lawmakers who also held ministerial titles have lost their seats. Nonetheless, Mahama's National Democratic Congress Party has called the vote flawed and indicated they would appeal. While Ghanaian police say there were some violent incidents during the election that left five dead, election observers say the vote was largely free and fair. Political analysts say the mixed results show Ghana's democracy is maturing. Mame Adjua Gichi Jando is head of the University of Ghana's Political Science Department. She says there is a growing trend of split-ticket voting for the president and lawmaker from opposing parties.
The shows that the electorate quite mature. They can see when you do work, when you work in the constituency, and you do not forget about them, they reward you.
Emmanuel Akwete is executive director of Ghana's Institute for Democratic Governance. He says the results should also prevent one party from pushing through laws with little debate.
I think with the new situation we have, they would be forced to discuss a little bit more, probably accommodate the opposition views a little bit more.
Over 13 million Ghanaians voted in the election, surprising some analysts who were expecting lower numbers due to voter apathy and the COVID-19 pandemic. Christopher Formagno is Regional Director for Central and West Africa at the Washington-based National Democratic Institute. In Ghana, to support domestic election observers, he says the turnout shows a commitment to democracy.
As long as we see this citizen engagement, it means that other tenets of Ghanaian democracy that include civil society advocacy, civil society monitoring of electoral processes, legislative oversight, that those other tenets would come out strengthened by the level of citizen engagement that we've seen.
This election was the third and presumably final time that Akufo-Addo and Mahama will face off for the presidency. Ghana's constitution allows presidents a maximum of 2 4-year terms. Mahama bested Akufo-Addo in 2012 but lost in 2016. Stacey Knott for VOA News, Accra.
Following the declaration of the results of Ghana's election, supporters of the newly re-elected president, Nana Akufo-Addo, began celebrating in the streets late into late night yesterday. VOA's Peter Cloete was in the middle of those celebrations in Accra, where he spoke to voters.
As you are seeing, we've won the election. I'm an MPP man, and we are happy. We're all Ghanaians, though, but we are happy that the MPP has won the election. And we are happy that everything is going on peacefully, and we are all enjoying. Nothing like fighting or something. We all have to enjoy the election and move on. Four more. Free SHS, free water, free light, free everything, free Ghana. Four more.
So sweet, resounding victory. But we thank God.
So what do you expect from Nana in the next 4 years?
I think we expect more from him because he has done a lot. So he's going to continue his flashy project. That's what we expect. We are going to even improve the senior high school, the free senior high school. The shift system is going to eliminate it, you know. He got a lot for us, so we thank God. He's the right person for Ghana.
He will do more as he has been doing it. Excuse me to say, my children specifically, sometimes, I remember it having money on me and I have to pay my school, my children's school fees and other things. But when Nana came to power, things changed to my side. Things actually automatically, it got changed.
This government have brought a whole lot to the country. Let's say free education, free HSS. It has given equality to everyone. Someone whose daughter or what can't afford Achimota can now go to Achimota without paying anything. We have enjoyed water, we have enjoyed light throughout the COVID-19. We expect more to come. More, the road, infrastructure, everything, education-wise, everything.
Those are the voices of voters in Accra, Ghana, brought to us by our own Peter Kloti. Refugees fleeing the fighting in Ethiopia say they do not know the fate of their families left behind as they arrive at remote camps in Sudan. VOA's Heather Murdoch has this report from the Umm Rakuba camp in eastern Sudan.
This camp now houses many of the more than 46,000 refugees who recently fled war in Ethiopia's Tigray region. Hundreds more are arriving every day, despite border closings inside the conflict zone. Mothers here say they tried to cover their children's eyes as they fled, but some as young as 4 years old still asked, "Who killed these people?" when they saw slaughtered bodies strewn on the streets. Families here tell a gruesomely similar story. This is Hawa Tesfaye, a mother of four who recently fled Ethiopia. She says she has seen horrible things before, but never the brutality of recent weeks. The conflict began in November, and it is unknown how many people are dead, wounded, or missing, as the Ethiopian central government and local forces battle for control of the Tigray region. But there is a lot currently unknown about civilians still inside the war zone, as they are largely cut off from aid workers and journalists. Reports say a huge amount of people there are in desperate need of immediate help, and tensions on the ground are growing. Heather Murdoch, VOA News, Umm Rakuba Camp, Sudan.
It's been nearly 2 weeks since Ethiopian Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed claimed an end to military operations in the northern Tigray region, but reports this week say fighting continues amid allegations of human rights abuses and of Eritrea's involvement in the conflict. Meanwhile, the UN and aid groups still do not have access to the war-torn region. For analysis of the situation, VOA's Jason Patinkin reached out to William Davison, who is senior analyst for Ethiopia at the International Crisis Group.
Yes, I think what we saw there was obviously, you know, a very significant moment, the capture of the regional capital, and therefore, you know, the Tigrayan government or former government, you know, becoming a rebel movement. But that didn't mean that all of those leadership you know, from Tigray, who are wanted by the federal government for various crimes, they are still at large. And so there is very much still the federal objective to capture them and bring them to justice. So, you know, since that announcement from the Prime Minister, we've seen fairly heavy fighting in areas, particularly sort of to the west of the capital, Mekelle, and also sort of south of Adwa. And that engagements along you know, main roads where there are exits into the mountainous areas where the leadership is. And then I've also received information That there has been very fairly heavy bombardment of probably more rural areas where the leadership has been based as well.
There have also been numerous allegations that have emerged over the past week about the involvement of Eritrean forces. How confirmed is that? How much involvement has there been by Eritrean forces crossing into Tigray to fight?
Well, what we really have is still clearly official denials from Asmara and from Addis Ababa, and then these very consistent allegations of heavy involvement from the Tigrayan side. And then I think, from other sources, what we have is a sort of piling up of anecdotal evidence. So some stuff from diplomats, from foreign governments, saying that they've been using satellite imagery, plotting the involvement of Eritreans. Also sort of firsthand accounts from the ground, some of them filtering through indirectly. So like I say, the anecdotal evidence is stacking up, but maybe, we could also say there isn't that real smoking gun in terms of concrete evidence, and it's still a question of claim and counterclaim from the parties directly involved about the Eritrean involvement.
Yeah, and one of the big challenges here to really understand or know what is happening is access to Tigray remains mostly cut off. Abiy said that aid would flow in after the capture of Mekelle, and the UN has had an agreement to move in, but it appears that really hasn't transpired.
Well, what we have, in line with the first exchange, we have an ongoing conflict situation, and we have a situation where the federal government has taken control in some regards, but also still has other military objectives. Now, this also translates into the situation with regards to media access and humanitarian access. There is a very little bit of media access going on, particularly in areas that the federal government controls. The UN, and therefore the humanitarian world, has an agreement with the federal government to deliver aid, but only in the areas that the federal government controls. Now, clearly, that isn't all of Tigray at the moment. So really, it's a question of, how is the conflict going to develop? Because that will depend on how the federal government, what sort of access it allows to journalists, and the aid agencies.
That is William Davison, senior analyst for Ethiopia at the International Crisis Group, speaking to VOA's Jason Patinkin. Hundreds are protesting on Thursday, International Human Rights Day, in Cameroon, calling for an end to separatist violence and Boko Haram terrorism. The two conflicts have killed tens of thousands of people in the country, as Moki Edwin Kinzeka reports from Yaoundé.
Hundreds of people, most of them women and children, sing at the city center in Cameroon's capital, Yaoundé, for peace to return to the Central African state. Mouma B. Yvonne of the Cameroon Women's Peace Movement says human rights abuses are becoming unbearable, with women and children the most common victims.
A true truce should be observed, a ceasefire, and a dialogue where all stakeholders shall be invited, called those who have taken upon themselves to be kidnapping should be booked, and anybody who perpetrated desecration, be you of the military corps or of the non-state armed group, justice served accordingly.
Yvonne said they organized the protest as part of activities marking the 2020 International Human Rights Day observed on December 10. The Cameroonian military has been fighting Boko Haram, the Nigeria-based Islamist terrorist group, since 2016. The military accuses the group of regular killings, abductions and burnings of mosques, churches, markets and schools. The fighting has displaced over 2 million and left more than 7 million in need of humanitarian aid. The United Nations reports that 3,000 people have been killed and 550,000 displaced since fighting broke out with English-speaking separatists in the French-majority country in 2016. In its 2020 report, Human Rights Watch says both armed groups and government forces have been committing widespread human rights abuses across Cameroon. The report says government forces and armed separatists have even killed, assaulted, or kidnapped people with disabilities. Both the military and separatist fighters have admitted quite often that human rights abuses such as abductions, beheading of women and children, and killing of innocent civilians exist. In some cases, the government has blamed the military and opened investigations. Feka Pashibel is coordinator of the organization Hope for Vulnerables and Orphans. She says rebels and the military should drop their weapons if they truly want peace to return to Cameroon. She says the fighting has deprived hundreds of thousands of children of their right to education. Feka says dozens of children have been killed for going to school.
It's been 4 years of suffering. The killings have not brought any solution and will not bring any solution. We are tired of crying, of running away from home, of getting into sex work. We are tired of being slaves just to survive. Drop your guns, end the bloodshed.
Feka said Cameroon should organize what she called a true national dialogue with separatist leaders to stop human rights abuses. Marie-Thérèse Abena-Ontua, Cameroon's Minister of Women's Empowerment, says the government is committed to bringing peace, but that fighters should drop their weapons.
Prime Minister John Gute was in the Northwest and Southwest, and he spoke to them in a language that they all understand. So I'm begging them to listen to his cry and that they should give up violence. We have all become beggars of peace, and each of us has a role to play so that our beloved country can become a land of peace.
Cameroon held a so-called major national dialogue last year to solve the country's crisis, especially the Anglophone separatist crisis, but fighting has continued with gross human rights violations, according to the UN. Moki Edwin Kinzuka for VOA News, Yaoundé, Cameroon.
A group of activists and celebrities, including a co-founder of the Black Lives Matter movement, have signed an open letter to Nigeria's president demanding that he hold accountable security personnel accused of shooting anti-police brutality protesters. The letter, published in the New York Times on Thursday to mark International Human Rights Day, comes nearly 2 months after what witnesses and Amnesty International say was a fatal clash in Lagos between peaceful protesters and military and police. The military and police deny shooting protesters. The demonstrators had called for an end to police brutality and a much-hated unit called the Special Anti-Robbery Squad, or SARS. Black Lives Matter co-founder Opal Tometi, 36, an American with Nigerian parents, organized the letter after watching the protests descend into violence. Tometi said she had friends and family in Nigeria, but said it was not difficult to get others to sign on. Spokesperson for President Muhammadu Buhari did not immediately respond to a request for comment. Police disbanded SARS on October 11th, and the government asked each state to form judicial panels to investigate claims of brutality. Coronavirus has claimed the lives of more than 1.5 million people and has devastated economies. But one of the world's leading epidemiologists say COVID-19, as terrible as it has been, has also empowered humanity in several unexpected ways. Darren Taylor has more.
Professor Salim Abdul Karim says the pandemic resulted in a rapid explosion of new scientific knowledge, with almost 100,000 academic papers on the coronavirus published since March. The scientist says many websites have dropped their paywalls, giving the public free access to the latest scientific information.
We're seeing enhanced collaboration across the world. We're seeing multidisciplinary research in ways that we haven't seen before. In essence, we have seen a transformation of science from what used to be the domain of elderly, gray-haired gentlemen in a library at the university, to one where anyone with a computer can now start in their homes looking at all of this information on COVID-19. It's a new level of accessibility and immediacy. You can see what's going on.
This, says the man leading South Africa's medical battle against COVID-19, has ignited an interest in science that's never been seen before.
Lay people are now using epidemiological concepts. I have my nephews WhatsApping me about, did yesterday's case fatality rate change by 2%? Today, we're seeing all of these individuals undertaking complicated analyses, looking at the number of tests and wondering why they're not doing enough tests this week.
Karim recalls that South Africa identified its first infection on the 5th of March. Soon after, its government imposed a lockdown, causing anxiety and fear. He says that simply wasn't sustainable.
We had to move from a situation where people were anxious, from anxiety, to agency, where they could now start taking control of their own lives and influencing their own risk.
To get to that point, Karim and his team had to convince the public that science had proven that measures such as hand sanitizing, mask wearing, and social distancing could prevent many new infections. The scientist acknowledges there are still clusters of selfish people disobeying safety regulations and putting their lives and those of others at risk. But he says most communities have realized the importance of community action, and they shun people who don't wear masks and don't socially distance. Karim says the adage of knowledge is power has never been truer.
Everybody now talks about epidemiology, and people are seeing how that scientific evidence empowers them to be able to act and to take agency over their own lives. And science has now become the bulwark against conspiracy theory, fake news, fearmongers.
The professor says COVID-19 has been and will continue to be a great tragedy, but he says because of it, humanity has gained a level of scientific knowledge that will in the future protect many people from dangerous false beliefs. For VOA News, I'm Darren Taylor in Johannesburg.
And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehayes Wuhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Mokbili Abaro, thank you again for tuning in and choosing the Voice of America.
Host of Music Time in Africa. Join me every Saturday and Sunday for an hour of awesome African music. Wake up, dance this music. Like to stay on top of new music trends, breakout artists, new releases? Maybe you just love the classic styles and artists of the past. Or simply the sound and feel of a good beat. Whatever your pleasure, you can get it every week right here on Music Time in Africa. So join me on your local FM station, Saturdays and Sundays at 1500 and 2000 UTC.
VOA brings you the best in African music on the African beat. African Beat showcases the latest and the greatest of contemporary African music, from bobo music to hip life, bonga flavor to soukous, Afrobeat to ndombolo and makossa to kwaito. The African Beat on VOA has it all. And it's happening right here, Mondays through Fridays at 09:05 and 20:05 UTC, right after the international news.
The Voice of America's Global News Program, International Edition, brings you an in-depth look at the biggest news stories of the day. Nobody covers the world more comprehensively than VOA. Our correspondents gather the news and the views of the most seasoned experts on international issues. Tune in Monday through Friday at 3:30 and 1705 UTC on the Voice of America.